you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest on the show today is Kay Bacante, founder of Red Bay Coffee in Oakland, California, which started out as a wholesale business, ultimately leading to the opening of a storefront in 2016. On a mission to diversify both the look and feel of the specialty coffee business in America, Conte's business model for Red Bay considers issues of equity and fairness at all points along the supply chain, from where the coffee is grown and how much growers are paid, to how much his own baristas and employees receive in pay and profit sharing, so they can continue to afford to live in rapidly gentrifying communities like the Bay Area. In addition to his love of coffee and his business acumen within the coffee industry, Conte is also an accomplished photojournalist who brings art, both his own and that of others, to the workplace. He covered the election of Nelson Mandela in South Africa and had a successful career as a music photographer in San Francisco. Conte earned his BA from San Francisco State in 1994, and his work has been exhibited in museums and galleries, including the California African American Museum and the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. And I'll be back in just a second with Kay Bacante. Stick with me. So, over the last several weeks, as you know, I've talked about it on this show a couple times, we've been talking about this phenomena. I'm not going to call it a recent phenomena because it actually dates back quite a while, but it's certainly come into stark focus over the last 3 weeks, this phenomena of white people calling police on folks of color over some bullshit. First of these stories, of course, to sort of pierce the veil of public consciousness in this last month being the case out of the Philadelphia Starbucks. Two guys come in waiting for a third person to show up to talk about a real estate deal or something. They're there for 2 minutes, hadn't purchased anything yet, so the manager decides to call the cops on them for trespassing. We've all heard that story. They were held detained for 8 hours, finally released. Starbucks apologized. They're going to be shutting down here in a few weeks to train 8,000 store employees or 8,000 stores and all the employees therein on issues of implicit bias, which, you know, is fine. And I'm going to be talking today actually on the show to Kay Bacante of Red Bay Coffee out in Oakland about maybe a different model, not simply training existing big corporate structures, which is fine and good, but actually creating small businesses owned and operated by people of color with a diverse mix of people working there where this kind of thing will be less likely to happen in the first place, creating business enterprises that are rooted in an entirely different model altogether. So that's not to say that we don't want Starbucks to train its people, but we also got to think about, you know, creating our own institutions. And for people of color, you know, that means creating institutions not only owned and operated by black and brown folk, but also catering to the needs of black and brown peoples in their communities. Not to say white folks aren't welcome in those spaces, but going to have to be a different kind of white person, not the kind of white person that's going to call the cops over some bullshit. So that was the first case. And again, I'll talk with Kay Bacante about that, among other things, in a minute. But Shortly after the Starbucks incident, we have the incident at the LA Fitness in New Jersey. Two black guys go in to work out, one of whom is a member, the other on a guest pass. The white folks at the front desk decide that they don't belong there, that they haven't paid, that they aren't members. They were, of course, but they decided they weren't, so they called the cops. Cops come out. Cops totally confused by why they got called. This video goes viral. The LA Fitness employees were fired, which is great. Then a day later, I guess it was, or at least the same couple of days, the black women on the golf course in York, Pennsylvania, who got the cops called on them for supposedly playing too slowly, which they weren't. They had finished the front nine holes of the 18-hole course well in advance of the time allotted for doing so, but some white folks didn't want them there, decided to harass them, call the cops on them. Then we had the black guy in New York City, used to work for the Obama administration, moving back from D.C. to New York on the Upper West Side, moving into his new apartment, and gets the cops called on him that night for being in the hallway with boxes. You know, pretty much tells you that you're moving in, but have all your stuff in the hall. You're probably not there, you know, to rob the joint. Pretty clear. You got boxes. You're moving in, but somebody sees him. Oh my God, call the cops. Black man in the hall. Yeah, black man in the hall in an apartment in Harlem. Imagine that. Imagine that. Of course, Harlem is gentrifying and white folks are not just bringing their bodies and their money, but they're also bringing their attitude. And so this guy gets the cops called on him. Then we have the women in California leaving the Airbnb. White neighbor calls the cops on them, thinks that they're apparently robbing the Airbnb and putting stuff in their suitcases to get into a car and leave. And because this white woman waved and they didn't wave back. Oh, well, that's the universal sign of I'm stealing shit. I didn't wave back. Therefore, I must be a thief, right? Calls the cops on them. You had the two Native American brothers who were at Colorado State University doing a tour, I guess. And there was a white lady there, freaked out. She and her little white daughter who were thinking about, you know, maybe the white daughter's going to enroll at Colorado State. But oh my gosh, there are these brown men, these Indian men. My goodness, they're all dressed in black. Oh my God. Got to call the cops. They're acting weird. So call the cops on these two guys and they end up missing the rest of their tour. Colorado State, to its credit, has reached out to them and not only apologized profusely, but seems to be really doing everything it can to ensure these two young men that if they want to come to Colorado State, they will be welcome there. I hope that they will not only extend an offer of enrollment to those two guys, but will tell this mother that she can keep her daughter at home and homeschool her ass for college or send her to some other place where that family bigotry will be allowed and tolerated, but it's not going to be at Colorado State. In any event, we had that incident. Then we have the incident at the dorm at Yale University where the black graduate student falls asleep in a common room doing some work, and a white graduate student calls the cops on the black woman who fell asleep in the common room studying because you're not supposed to sleep there. Oh, you can't sleep here. And the cops come out. You have the black folks at the park by the lake in Oakland. White woman, you probably saw this video, right? Calls the cops because they're barbecuing with a charcoal grill in the park. Something this guy had done, he said, literally for like decades, right? And yes, there's some new ordinance that had been passed that said certain parts of the park you could barbecue, but not with charcoal. You had to use like a gas grill. Other parts you could use a charcoal grill. And apparently it's true. The rules had changed. In this particular stretch of the park, you weren't supposed to use charcoal, but really, we're going to call the cops over that bullshit? I mean, it stretches the imagination to understand what, other than a sense of deeply held white supremacy, bigotry, hatred, and just all around fuckery, would lead anyone to call the cops over some folks just sitting around barbecuing at the park. I mean, it's stunning, these incidents. You had the woman on the American Airlines plane. Her name is Amber Phillips, by the way. You can follow her on Twitter at Amber J. Phillips. I'm going to try to get her on the show here at some point. She is a writer, a digital media and organizing strategist, co-host of At Black Joy Mixtape podcast. And she was on this plane. She had the cops called on her when she got off the airplane. I guess the white woman she was sitting next to, right, was upset I guess her arm was touching her because, you know, first of all, it's one of these small planes. I fly on them all the time. I have like 56 seats or whatever. And, you know, it's 2x2 and they are tight, man. You got to be like really super skinny. If you're just an average sized person, let alone if you're a bigger person, you're going to spill over, right? You're going to touch your person sitting next to you. And I don't like being touched either. You know, I like my privacy and my space. But when I get on a plane that has 56 friggin' seats, I know the odds are incredibly good, unless I'm sitting next to a 7-year-old, that I'm probably going to end up touching them, and they're going to probably touch me, and I'm just going to have to suck it up and deal with it. But this white woman couldn't deal with it. She kept complaining and huffing and puffing. Finally, Amber Phillips got her phone out and started videotaping the interaction. She never put her hands on this white woman. She never touched this white woman, never assaulted this white woman. But the woman lied, right? Told the flight attendants that she had been assaulted. The flight attendant then calls the police. The police come and, you know, interrogate this woman after she gets off the plane for so-called assault. This is just one after the other, after the other, after the other. And I'm sure by the time you probably hear this, there will be two or three more. Now, I want to say a couple things about this. Number one, of course, let's be real clear. This is not really a new thing. You know, Tamir Rice is dead today because someone saw him playing with a toy gun in a park in Cleveland, not threatening anyone, not hurting anyone, doing what kids do, playing with toy guns. I'm not a big fan of kids playing with toy guns, but white kids do this all over America, and they don't get the cops called on them, and the cops don't roll up and then shoot them within a second of encountering them, which is what happened to Tamir Rice. John Crawford killed in a Walmart outside of, what was it, Dayton, because some white guy sees him walking around with an air rifle that I beg to remind you, he plucked off of the shelf at the Walmart, and he's on the phone. He's basically standing with the air rifle down to his side, leaning on it like a cane, sort of swinging it back and forth at his side in a leisurely manner, which, by the way, if you're about to shoot up the Walmart with an actual rifle, even if it were real, like if I were there to shoot up the Walmart, wouldn't you think I probably wouldn't be taking the time to like make a phone call? He was sitting there talking to his girlfriend or his wife, or this is the mother of his child. I'm not sure if they were married or not, but he's on the phone to her. Like, if I'm there to shoot the joint up, man, I'm not going to sit there in aisle 7 and just like make a call while I got my weapon at my side. But this white dude sees him, flips out, calls the cops. Cops come in, they shoot him. It's all on videotape. And of course, the cop lied, but wasn't indicted, wasn't prosecuted. Said that John Crawford pointed the weapon at him. He never did. So that was about calling the cops on some bullshit. Even Trayvon Martin, if you think about it, that incident, that encounter between George Zimmerman and Trayvon begins with George Zimmerman calling the cops. The first thing he did was to call the police. Now, granted, when the cops told him, hey, sit tight, we got this, you know, he couldn't do that because George Zimmerman fashioned himself a big bad lawman who was more powerful and had more authority than he really did. But, you know, even if he had sat tight and the cops had come, you know, things sadly could have ended up the same that night because, as with Tamir Rice, as with John Crawford, as with Eric Garner, as with so many folks who are black and brown who've had the cops called on them, it doesn't end up well. So it isn't just even Zimmerman taking off on his own to go chase Trayvon down and confront him, but even his initial idea of, I got to call the cops on this black kid because he's walking around. I've never seen him. And what's he doing? You know, walking around in the rain, you know, just again, calling the cops on some bullshit. So this isn't new. Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates, professor at Harvard, one of the best known black academics, or maybe one of the best known academics, period, on the planet. Remember back in 2009, was coming home from a trip trying to get into his own house in Cambridge, Mass, where he had lived for several years. And a white woman who lived in the neighborhood, who surely has to have seen Skip Gates at some point in the time that they both had lived in the neighborhood, sees this black guy, 57 years old at the time, as I recall, trying to get into his house. Apparently, he'd locked himself out, didn't have the key, whatever. He gets out of his car. He had a driver with him. Skip Gates himself walking on a cane, trying to get into his house. And she asks another white woman, another white neighbor, to call the cops for her because there's this 57-year-old black man trying to break into a house. Yes, of course, because 57-year-old black men who walk on a cane often are your B&E suspects. And the cops come and they have this ugly confrontation with Skip Gates. And then, of course, it became a big story because President Obama knew Henry Louis Gates, of course, from Harvard and felt as though and said that the police in Cambridge had acted stupidly, which he then got raked over the coals for. But it was an accurate statement, wasn't it? Because actually, it was stupid to arrest Henry Louis Gates for a crime he didn't commit. They arrested him for disorderly conduct, but actually the state law in Massachusetts, the Supreme Court of that state, has said that it's not disorderly conduct nor against the law, any other law, for a citizen to yell at cops. They may not like it, and I don't recommend it, but it's not against the law. That actually has been adjudicated as such twice by the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts. So if Massachusetts law says that what Henry Louis Gates did ain't illegal, then for you, the law enforcement official, to arrest him on some shit that isn't against the law means you're an idiot. It means you indeed did act stupidly. But of course, when Barack Obama said that, he was accused of trying to destroy a white officer, right? Because of some black bonding that we know Barack Obama was so famous for. So there was that incident, cops getting called on some bullshit. There was a 6-year-old girl back in 2012 in Milledgeville, Georgia, who was handcuffed after police were called by her school because she was throwing a tantrum in the classroom. You know, she was out of control. Yes, she was throwing stuff. She was breaking some things. She was having a tantrum, having a meltdown, which I got to tell you, sometimes kids do that, right? And certainly not just black children. There are children who lose control sometimes. That is because partly that's what children do. And secondly, there are kids who have some real emotional issues and some real control issues. But you don't have to call the cops on them, but they did. And this six-year-old child was handcuffed. She was initially charged with battery of a teacher and criminal damage to property. They were going to charge a six-year-old child and give her a record because they didn't know how to calm her down. I mean, you know, this is why you go to school and learn how to be a teacher, a counselor, an administrator, a principal. That should be part of it. If you don't know how to calm a child down, if you don't have techniques other than calling the cops, we're in real trouble in this country. But that's what they did. We had a black teenager who had the cops called on him in New York City for buying a $300, $350 belt at Barney's at the department store, right? Because how in the world could he possibly afford a $350 belt as a black male in America? So the cops come and they harass him on some bullshit. There was a young black woman in Florida, high school student, who was arrested, had the cops called on her because of a science experiment she was doing at school that went wrong. And there was like a small explosion. It wasn't intentional. It was an accident. She mixed some stuff together. It reacted wrong. There was like this pop. Didn't hurt anybody. No one was injured. They called the cops on her. Right. And there are other incidents. I mean, I'm sure I'm leaving out as many as I've included. My point I'm just trying to make is that this really isn't new. This has been happening for quite a while. And yet, having said that, I do want to say that there does seem to be something a little different about this recent spate of incidents. And I don't know if we can simply presume that it is business as usual. There seems to be something deeper happening, even though this is a longstanding trend. First off, it seems a little different because those earlier incidents and the outcomes of so many of those, right, like Trayvon, like Tamir Rice, like John Crawford, the outcomes of those are so well known now. That has been such a thing in the news that white Americans cannot possibly claim to be ignorant as to the risks that we set in motion when we call 911 on black folks. Maybe in 2009, 2010, 11, and 12, you could say, oh, people just weren't realizing what the consequences were. But now, with case after case after case over the last several years of black folks being shot, or in the case of Eric Garner, being choked out on the streets of New York City by the cops after they got called on him for some bullshit, white folks know now what can happen. And often does happen. And what we're basically saying when we make that call over some bullshit is we are willing to set in motion a process that we know could result in the death or serious injury of a black person. Now, obviously, if there is a true emergency, life-threatening situation, if someone is being physically, truly threatened by someone who happens to be black, or if some people are breaking into your house and they happen to be black, I'm certainly not going to counsel that you look out the window and say, oh, well, it's just black people, so I won't call the cops. I'll let them break into the house. Obviously, you know, something like that is different, but none of these situations are like that. This is not some serious shit. This is a presumption of shoplifting. It's the presumption of playing golf too slow. It is the, you know, whatever. The presumption of trespassing. None of this is serious shit. And yet white folks are willing to say, yeah, I'm willing to call the cops, even though I know what happened to Tamir Rice. I know what happened to Trayvon. I've seen the video of Eric Garner. White folks know this stuff is going on, right? If for no other reason that we're so pissed that black people keep bringing it up, we're aware of it. So what we are saying is that we are willing to set in motion a chain of events that we know could result in death. That is how cavalierly some of us apparently take black life. It is the ultimate authority trip for entirely fragile white folks. And by that I mean, you know, the kind of white folks who are so fragile that when we have some type of situation, like the woman, you know, at the park in Oakland, at the lake with the barbecue, right? Rather than just sort of like letting it go, like there's just such a fragility, like, oh, black folks are getting away with something, right? Or they're getting one over on us. They're getting away with something. They're getting away with sitting in the Starbucks and not buying anything. Well, I'll show them. Or they're buying an expensive item at the Barney's or the Macy's or whatever, right? Well, we'll show them. Just this fragility, this inability of white people to just let black and brown folks be. Just mind your own business and not be so uptight when you think black people are doing something that's not quite right. Oh my God, they're barbecuing and technically you're not supposed to have charcoal here. So therefore, I'm going to call the emergency number. Or there's this black woman sleeping in the common area of the dorm, which, I mean, I'm sorry, if you're a serious student, we've all done that. I remember falling asleep in the library. I remember falling asleep in the common area of my residence hall, my freshman year, at the very least, maybe my sophomore year. I lived in the dorms then too. You know, it happens, but it's this fragility, like, oh, we can't let this person get away with anything. It's the ultimate authority trip, because we know deep down, whether it's conscious or subconscious, that the police are an extension of us under white supremacy, that the police are like another appendage of our whiteness. They are the ultimate way in which we're like, well, when all else fails, we can just call the cops, because A, we know they'll come. B, we assume they'll be on our side, as they so often will be. And C, we'll show these black people, or we'll show these brown people, or we'll whatever. And I have to think that even though this shit has been going on for an awful long time, it seems like it is being made more likely by the current political climate, right? Because we're in a particular place right now as a nation where the overall mood of an awful lot of white people is, for lack of a better way to put it, and I apologize for the profanity, but basically the mood is fuck these people, meaning black folks, meaning Latinos, meaning indigenous people, meaning just people of color generally, right? The mood is just fuck them, right? We don't have to care. White people are back in charge. We're running shit now. You know, as I've said many times, the election of Donald Trump in some ways was just a symbolic gesture. It was the equivalent of guys grabbing their nuts just to show the liberals, just to show the black people, just to show the people of color, the LGBTQ folk, the feminists, right? Just here, it's just, let me grab my balls. Because that's like the entirety of Trumpism, right? It's just attitude. It's just bluster. It's just, you know, fuck you is basically all it is. It's one big middle finger to all the groups that these right-wing white men in particular, and some of the women who love them, it's all the people they don't like. And in that political climate, if you see a person of color who you think isn't acting the way you'd like them to, or who is misbehaving in some way, breaking some minor ass rule, or not even breaking a rule at all, but just you think they are, well, that's an excuse to call the cops. Screw them. And it sort of connects to, if you remember, right after the election, I talked about this on the show as well, right after the election of Donald Trump, there were all these videos, you'll recall. There was, including, I should point out, one in Starbucks, right? There was a Starbucks where this white guy goes in. I guess he was getting bad service. You know, it happens, right? I mean, Starbucks gets busy. Jesus. I mean, you get slow service, or I don't know, he got soy milk with his latte and he flipped out because he really wanted 2% or some shit. I don't know. Whatever it was, you know, it's relatively minor in the larger scheme of life events and setbacks that ought to make you upset. But he got what he considered to be bad service. And so he goes off, and it's all on videotape. He goes off on this black barista at Starbucks and accuses her of giving him bad service because he's white, that it's reverse discrimination, blah, 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 blah. You know, because first of all, like, as I said before, if you're a white person who thinks that, like, getting bad service at Starbucks is racial oppression, please, will you come with me on the road when I try to prove white privilege to people? Because you're like a walking, talking example of it. Like, when you say that shit, if you think bad service at the Starbucks is oppression, you clearly have never been oppressed. So you're actually the living embodiment of white privilege and white fragility. Oh my God, I had to wait 5 extra minutes. You're a bigot. And then this white guy goes off and says, I voted for Trump. What do you think about that? Like that, you know. So that's why I'm connecting it to Trumpism, right? Because here's a guy who clearly, in the wake of the election, was like grabbing his balls, metaphorically speaking, and saying to this black woman, you're trying to victimize me, you're a reverse racist, I voted for Donald Trump, and we're running shit now. And then there was the guy on the airplane, white dude in the airplane, gets up, goes off, you know, says, did y'all vote for Hillary? You know, starts throwing around all these sexist slurs, and, you know, and he starts chanting Trump, 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 and all this bullshit. And then there was the white woman in the Chicago Michaels store, arts and crafts store, right, got pissed off, bent out of shape because the black clerk who was checking her out offered her or encouraged her to buy a one or maybe a $2, I don't know what it was, some little reusable bag, right? Because the stuff she had wasn't going to fit in the cheap plastic bag. So she's like, hey, why don't you buy a $1 or $2 reusable bag and you can bring it back next time you come. And this white woman goes, just loses her mind, right? Starts accusing the black woman of reverse discrimination. Then she too starts talking about how she voted for Trump and what do you think about that and all this other bullshit. So the overall mood of the country right now is it's taking all these white folks who are on this authority Jones, right? Who want to trip out on black folks, but feel like for 8 years they couldn't, I guess, because Obama was in charge. He had to sort of keep it tighter to the vest or whatever, even though many of them didn't, because like I said, cops were getting called. But now they're just like, they're just popping off. Popping off is part of it, and then calling the cops is the other part of it, right? This is all part of a piece. It's all part of a piece of the attitude of whiteness right now. This militaristic, masculine, bombastic whiteness that has always been there, but which now has just been sort of unleashed, and you know, the dog whistle is over. We're in the era of the bullhorn now. And I have to assume it's also that, you know, white folks know, or at least we assume, that police don't feel the need to be restrained anymore. And so if they overreact, nothing's going to be done. That's the really sick piece of this, right? Is that you've got some white folks who are calling the cops now. Not only do they know what could happen because they've seen all these incidents in the news, but they also have to, at least at a subconscious level, if not conscious level, know that this administration and this Justice Department won't do shit to cops if things go sideways. So it isn't just that you're willing to have bad stuff happen. You're willing to have bad stuff happen knowing that the people who are in uniform who do that bad stuff to the black folks upon whom you called those cops won't have any punishment meted out to them, because Jeff Sessions has made it real clear they ain't going to do anything to cops. So when white folks do this, they're an extension of Trumpism. They're an extension of this unleash the police bullshit that this administration has wrought. We have a moral and an ethical and a practical obligation to do something about this. And that means for those of us who are white, we've got to make it real clear to our brothers and our sisters and our colleagues and our neighbors and our friends and to ourselves that calling the police needs to not be the first resort or the second resort or the third resort, that it really needs to be the last resort, that it's the kind of thing, particularly with regard to black and brown folks, that we need to be very judicious about. You don't just call the cops. That the privilege that we possess that allows us to think of that as a good move, as a legitimate move, tells you everything you need to know about life in America. I have no doubt that there are black and brown folks who would love to have called some cops on some white people before for some of the bullshit that we do. But you know what? That's the irony of it. They don't. Even when we're in the wrong, black and brown folks ain't gonna call the cops on us most of the time, because they know that when the cops come, it'll be them who are more likely to be suspected of wrongdoing. Another example of privilege, another example of fragility, another example of white supremacy in action, kind of stuff conservatives deny. And of course, they'll deny every single one of these incidents they come up with a rationalization for. Well, they must have been doing something. Well, you know, technically, you're not supposed to barbecue in that area with charcoal. Blah, 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 blah. You're not supposed to fall asleep in the common area at the dorm at Yale. Shut up! Enough out of you. The fact that technically a rule has been violated does not justify calling out people who have the legal authority to beat you or kill you. It's time for white folks to talk a lot less when it comes to those subjects and listen a lot more to people of color. And it's also time for us to figure out something other than simply training other white people out of our bigotry. It's nice to do. We got to do it. I hope Starbucks' training of their employees works. But at the same time, we've also got to think about alternative models of development, including the support that we all need to be giving to black and brown owned businesses who have a different business model, a different attitude, a different connection to the community, where people of color can go and shop and recreate and hang out and congregate in peace without being worried that somebody's going to jump the gun and call the cops on them. And that is what, among other things, I'm going to talk today to Kay Bacante of Red Bay Coffee in Oakland about. I want to talk to him about his business model, about his coffee, because I don't know about you, but I'm addicted to coffee, so I love coffee. I just want to talk about that with him a bit. But I also just want to talk to him about what it means to create a business enterprise that isn't just about making money, but is about creating community. And that's what Kay Bacante has done in Oakland with Red Bay Coffee. They're about to expand to other parts of this country. And all of us ought to be supporting these black-owned and people of color-owned businesses, not simply asking white-owned businesses to do better, although we want them to do better, but saying we're going to start putting our money where our mouths are, literally and figuratively. We're going to start supporting black and brown-owned businesses all throughout our country. And if we do that, I promise you, some of those white businesses will begin to change, because they'll realize they're going to lose money if they don't. I'll be back in just a minute with Kay Bacante of Red Bay Coffee. Stay with me. So Kaba, first of all, thank you for joining me on the show today. To get started, why don't you let folks know a little bit about yourself and how you got into the business of coffee? I know that you are originally an artist by training and inclination, so that's sort of how you started, and yet you have sort of morphed from that into the owner of this incredible coffee shop and roaster, and I think it's an interesting story. So talk a little bit about that for folks who don't know the story of Red Bay Coffee.
You know, my training was as a photojournalist and a visual artist. I was born and raised in San Francisco. And to me, you know, once I had my art career established, that was my business. And really the connection to coffee, you know, the very first connection was building a coffee shop called Guerrilla Cafe, G-U-E-R-I-L-L-A, in North Berkeley. And I really built that cafe as a platform to showcase my artwork. Really got fascinated with the process of coffee and running of a brick and mortar style business, sourcing, you know, building a team. It was really fascinating, and the business worked right off of the bat and really kind of grew from there. And really it's become an extension of my artwork. It's hard to really tell where the art ends and the coffee begins. You know, I think art can show up in so many different manifestations. I mean, just the broad kind of categories. There's visual art, there's performing art, there's literary arts. You know, then there's another layer of arts, right? The more installation arts, the site-specific art, the conceptual art, the performance art of it. So the deeper I got into tapping into different expressions of my own creativity, the definition of art really started to expand for me. So I really saw art in many things that I did, and it showed up in many manifestations. You know, really, I think of art in terms of coffee, how it intersects with what I do, is creating something that is visually and mentally stimulating. It kind of captures your imagination. And, you know, as an artist, I was always trying to have a new take on maybe something that could be ordinary. So what's more ordinary than coffee? And what I wanted to bring to the coffee industry was having people sort of really question and think about how it's being prepared, you know, where it's being grown from, the whole process. Who is in your coffee shop? Why does your coffee shop look the way it does? Whose culture is carrying that platform forward? What sort of history are we tapping into? Are we going back to the coffee houses in Europe? Do we go back to the coffee, you know, ceremonies in Ethiopia at its origins? And, you know, so I'm really exploring all of those things. I'm exploring how is the money distributed and how is it distributed from the farmer to the barista and everywhere in between. So I think it's all material to explore as an artistic concept that has real life consequences.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of those real life, real world consequences, particularly, you know, so much as regards coffee and other forms of agriculture actually all around the world, which have definite consequences in terms of the supply chain, the living standards of the people who do the work. There's so many real world implications of the way commerce gets done. Talk a little bit about the social consequences and the development of a social conscience or consciousness around the way that coffee connects to those larger social issues.
So really coffee was is a slave crop. So, I mean, you could think of coffee like cotton or sugar. So the levels of history of exploitation have always been there. And as our society started to evolve and bring in these questions around, and we're seeing the impact that agriculture production is having on the planet, on the environment, and in parallel, there is social and civil rights movements that are also exploring these matters. And we're for sure trying to turn it up and bring those things to the discussion.
So I know that when it comes to coffee, for an awful lot of us, the most that we really know about it in terms of social consciousness or awareness is this concept of fair trade coffee, right? This idea that we want to make sure as sellers of coffee that we are engaged in fair trade with the full supply chain all the way back to the growers, making sure that folks are being paid an adequate amount for the incredibly difficult work that they do, knowing that so oftentimes that isn't the case, as you said. But I have to tell you that when I see, you know, someone saying that they are selling fair trade coffee, I don't necessarily know what that means. What does that really mean? Because I always worry that, you know, you can say you're fair trade coffee, but, you know, we also have a lot of products in the stores that are slapping an organic label on themselves. And I don't necessarily know what that means. I don't know if there's real quality control. I don't know if there are real standards in place. So I guess the first question is, what does it really mean? What does fair trade really mean? Is that a meaningful thing? And if so, explain how. And then secondly, is it sufficient? Or do we need to think more capaciously about the subject? Because, you know, to me, one of the things you have to worry about is, even if we're engaged in fair trade with the suppliers, how does that filter down to the store level? Let's say here in the United States, making sure that the folks who are selling the coffee are also receiving a wage that allows them to live in the communities where they work, because that seems to be part of it too, that maybe sometimes gets left out.
So fair trade is really the response on a global industrial level, trying to address the exploitation in agricultural products, sugar, cocoa, coffee, and others. So it was the effort of an organization, Fair Trade USA, Fair Trade International, to create some basic safety net of almost like a minimum wage for the supply chain and try to create some transparency. Fair Trade is a certification, and Fair Trade basically gets another, I think it's about 50 cents per pound back to the farm cooperative above the commodity price. Today, that's about $1.42. So that's another 50 cents on top of that, just for them growing coffee and moving coffee. And then that goes to their collective for them to decide how to spend that money. It was a good start to address the issue of exploitation. What it did not necessarily do was build any incentives for quality. And so they'll hit that baseline. What has been a movement in the sort of the third wave of coffee, that's the more specialty coffee segment and developed over the last 15 to 20 years, is doing something more like called direct trade. And, you know, so a direct trade is not an official certification. It is really just signaling that roasters are building direct relationships with farmers from, you know, anywhere around the world. And in our case, what we do is we pay them greater than commodity, greater than fair trade. We're paying them, so on average, around $3.30 a pound, which is almost double the commodity. And we are incentivizing them to higher standards to create higher quality coffee. In my experience, many of these farmers take pride in creating a better product, especially if they can get paid for the extra effort. So that's sort of fair trade and what we're doing, of direct trade. Once the coffee gets here, I think our industry in general has spent much less attention to addressing some of the issues of poverty, full-time working folks who really can't get by in areas like the Bay Area. You know, how we've tried to address that is paying our U.S.-based workers $15 out the gate is our minimum entry wage. If they're, you know, working in a coffee bar, then they get tips as well. If they're in the rest of the production of our company, then we're doing profit sharing, different sorts of equitable measurements. So that's how we're kind of addressing some of these things and trying to bring more equity into the industry.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that business model, because the idea of blending commerce and conscience obviously has been around for more than a minute. Certainly very prominent all the way back in the 1980s with the anti-apartheid movement, the anti-sweatshop movement in the late 90s, early 2000s. So, I mean, this concept of corporate responsibility, for instance, has been around for a while. And yet it obviously has not been the dominant mode of corporate thinking, which is still very much about the maximization of profits without a whole lot of concern for social responsibility. To what extent do you think that is changing, if you think it is? And to what do you ascribe that shift? Is there increasing interest in or pressure for, and therefore response to that pressure, to link the notions of commerce and social responsibility?
I think that things are changing. And even now, McDonald's is committing to raising their minimum wage. What it's the driving force these days is that it's not just mixing commerce with conscious, but it's really making smarter business decisions. Now, retention, employee retention is a very big issue in companies. It's very expensive to replace a staff member, an employee, to recruit someone, hire them, train them, get them up to speed is costly. So if you have a lot of turnover, that's a financial burden, you know, on any industry, on any company. So we find that if you just treat people better, make the conditions more equitable, create values in your organization that make people proud and aspire to want to continue to work there, then they'll stay with you longer. You know, we just came out with a report that we've got a 77% retention rate of our employees, which is about 25% higher than the national average. So we're also wanting to make a business case for it so companies don't have to rely on their good conscience, and the society doesn't have to rely on that. You know, really, if we can get a movement going and really demonstrate that you can have a successful business and that is it's a competitive advantage to treat people well. I think the bigger reason why that they're making changes is because the country, the customer base are demanding it. This millennial generation is demanding that companies that they do business with are more ethical, are having higher standards. They're thinking about the sourcing. They're thinking about how they're treating their, you know, their frontline employees. They're looking at sort of the corporate structure and the diversity and inclusion within the management and leadership of these companies. So I think that may be even a more compelling reason.
Well, it seems like when I look at the history of the development of Red Bay Coffee, there seems to have been a vision from the very start that was trying to push the industry perhaps in a different direction, to lead in a different direction. Even the way that you got started, you crowdsourced the money, right? Raised nearly $90,000 so you could build out the space. You didn't want to have to start out in debt. So you went to the community. They came out for you. They backed your vision. Talk a little bit about that and how you saw yourself and this particular enterprise fitting into the next wave of coffee in the coffee industry, if you will.
That was like 4 years ago when we ran that campaign, when, you know, every other coffee company is really just sort of fetishizing better coffee and better coffee. And that's the sort of platform everyone had held the standard to. You know, how can you make your coffee from a 96 to a 97 on this scoring piece? So I saw that, you know, really the discernible differences between excellent coffee and super excellent coffee were really tapped out. I didn't see much room to grow and to differentiate on quality. 15 years ago, you know, there was a lot of room for improvement. So really, coffee is a single ingredient. It is a complex process to make a great cup of coffee. But, you know, honestly, as an industry, we've had that figured out for 10 years now. So from the very beginning, I wanted to bring the next level, maybe the fourth wave, to this industry of not just, you know, what we're doing, but how we're doing it, with whom we're doing it, and what kind of impact that we're going to have. I think this is a moment in time where people want to see more equitable organizations out there. And that's what my proposition was. And that's why we had 822 people support that campaign to raise close to $90,000. And the people really understood and had empathy and connected to the message that we wanted to build an organization that was more equitable and more diverse. And they put their money where their mouth was. It was a big vote of confidence for us. It was before we had raised any, you know, real capital to build our business. So it was just a vote of confidence that's kind of lifted us to where we are today.
Yeah, let's talk about that diversity piece when it comes to the personnel. Because like you said, the coffee quality piece has been figured out for the most part for several years. But when it comes to personnel, perhaps that's not something that folks automatically think about, the importance of not only racial diversity, but diversity in terms of, you know, hiring folks with disabilities, in terms of gender equity, in terms of hiring folks who are formerly incarcerated persons, all of which has been a part of your business model. So talk a little bit about why you think that's important. And then the next piece also, beyond the sort of personnel diversity, is the community space aspect of your shop and of your facility. You are not only a place where folks can come and get good coffee, but also a place where folks congregate, and really it becomes more of a community space than some of the, you know, the big box coffee shops that people tend to think about. So talk a little bit about why that is also important.
I think that, you know, we basically owe it to our communities to have the makeup of your company, of your leadership, reflect your customers and the community around it. Because the disparity of the makeup, the demographic makeup of this specialty, this fancy coffee movement, looked so unlike the farmers that grew this coffee, right? This coffee comes from South America, you know, the Caribbean, Africa, Southeast Asia, and, you know, that demographic was just really not represented in the entire rest of that value chain. So in a way, we are trying to make up for that difference by really encouraging more people of color into this industry. And one way for us to do that is hire them ourselves, train them ourselves. We're trying to raise folks up, even people who are in not in our company, but they have a coffee shop. We are inviting them into our place to roast their coffee. We're training people how to roast their own coffee, you know, and elevate technical skills in this industry. So I think that's really important. And just on a product development side, you want to have a diversity of ideas and experiences and tastes to help develop products for the new general market. So in regard to the space and, you know, the community space, so what we've done is, of course, the arts and coffee and poetry and coffee have gone together, you know, very well for years. And, you know, that's nothing new. What we're doing is slightly different, or maybe turning that up a bit. So what we've done is, and we have a 6,000 square foot warehouse where we're roasting. So it's really a coffee roasting facility. And because it's a warehouse, we've got extra space. So we're able to host large events. There's films, there's lectures, there's conversations going on. There's, of course, parties and, you know, all sorts of performances. And so really we've created a platform, a venue for people to come together. And, you know, and it gives, there's a platform for the community. There's an opportunity for people to connect and link. And it's, again, also a business decision for, you know, wise business for us, because, you know, now many of the events that happen at Red Bay Coffee are hosted by, you know, outside groups. And, you know, so then they're bringing more people who had never been to our place before. So it builds brand awareness, you know, so it just wins on a lot of different levels.
So obviously, having you on right now, I need to ask you about the incident at the Philadelphia Starbucks, because I think it raises some bigger questions about the industry that you are in, as are they, and the larger sort of issue about the way in which people are treated in what ought to be community spaces, but sometimes obviously are not. So we all know the story about the two men who go in. They don't purchase anything in those first 2 minutes that they're there. The manager calls the cops on them. They get arrested for trespassing. Starbucks has apologized. They're going to be doing this training of their employees in a few weeks, which is obviously good. It's better to be trained than not to be. But I want to ask you about it, because sometimes it seems to me that when we talk about training white people, presumably, out of our racism, whether it's conscious or subconscious, explicit or implicit, there is still, almost by definition, a presupposition that for the foreseeable future, it's going to be white people in these positions to make this call to the police, to make this decision. And sometimes I think maybe rather than focusing on the training, though it is important, we need to be building different types of institutions similar to what you have done, right? I mean, if we've got coffee shops, and not just coffee shops, restaurants, bookstores, whatever it is, that are owned by people of color that have a greater diversity of representation, the odds of this kind of thing happening in the first place is obviously going to be quite a bit less. If we have community spaces that are there as places to gather and to congregate, then the fact that somebody comes in and hasn't bought anything for a couple minutes is not going to be, you know, a big deal. And so it seems like the whole concept of what you're trying to do is perhaps a longer-term structural institutional effort that could, if it were replicated, make a bigger difference than all the training in the world.
You know, actually, Starbucks does a pretty good job at diversity on the very front line workers. So you can go into a lot of communities in urban cities and find a pretty good mix of folks. But as you go up in the management structure, from the management to the regional manager to vice presidents and the leadership and the executive team, I guarantee you that that organization will get wider and wider and wider the higher you go up. And until the organization itself is more reflective of that new general market, these problems are going to persist. They've taken generations to sustain the society, and there is going to take generations to heal it. So yes, training, you know, always needs to happen. There's nothing wrong with that. That's good. That's a good first step. We applaud them. And while they're shut down for training, we're going to be open for conversations around race on that day. So we're actually on May 29th, when Starbucks closes 8,000 stores, I'm going to do a coffee tour of black coffee shops in Philadelphia and speak with different coffee owners. And we're going to be open for these conversations around race and equity and beautiful coffee and a whole host of issues.
Yeah. And you know, back to that piece about the space, I have to think, in addition to greater levels of diversity throughout the company or institution, it's also about the space. If the space in question is understood by the people who work there and by the customers who go to be a space of community congregation, not just a place where you go drink coffee and eat pastries, but a place where you get together and meet. And I think, you know, implicitly people know that's what folks do at coffee shops, but unless it is clearly defined as part of the mission of the space, you're going to have folks who are going to look at certain people there as perhaps not belonging. Whereas if it's understood as a community space, anyone who's from the community who's in there, presuming, you know, that they're not throwing stuff around and harassing people, is obviously going to be welcome. So isn't it also about the intentionality of the way that the space is utilized in terms of making sure that everyone is really welcome and that these kinds of incidents don't happen? Because, I mean, that kind of thing is just not going to happen at a store like yours. It's just not, right?
There's just no conceivable way that would happen, you know, at any black-owned coffee shop, right, or friendly space. You know, and people like to say, oh, yeah, Starbucks is getting, you know, punished for this one stupid manager's decision. It's such a naive position, because it's not just that one manager. These things happen all the time. These are the ones that you just get caught on video, right? Every time you see anything bad on video, you could just know it's happening 10 times a day off camera. And still, she is not operating in a vacuum. She is reflecting her management's view. So that's my take on it. Because of this whole Starbucks national sort of wake up around that, there is, you know, that space that people thought was a safe space is not so safe. You know, so we've gotten calls nationally to show up. And so we're poised to make this national expansion. We've got some major financial backers at the table now discussing big investments, and we're poised to make that move.
So let's talk about that expansion. When you think of that, do you worry at all that as you grow, the ability to maintain your mission,
yes,
as you grow? Yeah, right, of course, right?
Yes, but I do worry about it. This is really what I think about, and this is the process of me vetting our potential investors, yeah, right? Yeah. So, you know, when you hear impact, a lot of investors call themselves impact VCs. So they're like, yeah, we don't mind doing something good as long as we still get the crazy return. You know, so there's impact investors and there's people who generally get it. And, you know, luckily we're, you know, doing something exciting enough, and we're in an area where there's a big enough pool of people to have these various conversations with. So in terms of retaining these values as we scale and take on extra financial backing and dealing with the expectations of those investors, yeah, this is what we're working on. And part of our solution to that is why we became a B Corporation, which is stands for Benefit Corporation. It's a way for us to sort of embody these values in a legal structure so that, you know, we will not be in default of shareholder kind of prices, where, you know, we, by becoming a B Corp, we are able to list our stakeholders as not just shareholders, but our employees, the environment, our farmers, the community. And so that's one way of doing it. But, you know, and ultimately, it's It's making sure that there's alignment with the investors.
Right. So by being a B Corp and classifying yourself that way, if I understand it correctly, that means that you are not at risk of being, let's say, sued by investors or shareholders for not returning, you know, maximum profits on their investment, right? Which is what you would have to do if you had any other type of corporate structure. There would be this fiduciary responsibility to take care of them first. And what you're able to do, which again, I think is a fascinating model that more folks ought to look into, is say, listen, yeah, we're going to try to return a profit and return money to you, but we're also going to define other stakeholders, not just shareholders, stakeholders. As you said, the environment, the workers, the community. That gives you a significant amount of freedom, I guess, when you're approaching investors to just say up front, like, hey, this is what we're about. And if you're not down with that, then, you know, you God bless and good luck. And, you know, you can move on down the road. But that's what we're going to be about. So the folks who come to you with potential startup money to expand are going to know up front what they're getting into. Yes.
Yes. And that's why, you know, we became a B Corp before the investors showed up. So now, if they're maybe talking about being a, you know, an impact investor, yeah, but they see that we're a B Corp and they realize that that takes away some of the leverage that they could have later, then we could really just avoid that conversation. And there are some very, very successful B Corps out there that have raised tens and well over $100 million. Talking about Sundial Brands, Ripple Milk, you know, there's companies out there that are very successful and as a B Corp structure and raising that money. So it does help, you know, when there are models out there as well.
So where exactly are you going to be expanding in the near future? I know I've heard about Philly, but there's more than that, right?
Philly, Baltimore, Atlanta, and Southern California is sort of the first wave.
Well, that is really great. And I want to encourage anyone, obviously, in the Bay Area, but also in the places that Kaba just mentioned, to check out Red Bay Coffee. For those of us who want to stay in touch, find out about possibly further expansions or events in any of the shops once they are open or the one that is now. Or for those of us who want to get retail bags sent to us, because I know you also ship beans retail. So how can we, who want to get some of that coffee, actually go about doing that and stay in touch and find out what you all are up to?
To find out more, you know, to order coffee, they just go to our website, okay, redbaycoffee.com. We're mailing out retail bags every day. And, you know, some people have subscriptions, so they get, you know, a bag every couple of weeks or however long it lasts them. You know, as an artist and a photographer, you know, we really spend a lot of our energy on sharing images and stuff with on Instagram. You always, you know, check in there and see some of the work that we're doing. It's an easy way to just tap in. And we make announcements there too. But yeah, just stay tuned.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Gene Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song, Gather Round, as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.